This episode of Just the Right Book is brought to you by BetterHelp. Get on your way to being your best self. Give online therapy a try at betterhelp.com/rightbook. We are living in stressful times, and the hustle and bustle of the holidays can make it even more stressful. If you're considering starting therapy, try BetterHelp. It's entirely online and designed to be flexible and convenient. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with the best for you licensed therapist. Now is the time to give yourself what you need with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/rightbook today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/rightbook. This is Roxanne Cody. Thanks for listening. And now back to Just the Right Book. I'm Roxanne Cody, and welcome to Just the Right Book. A couple of weeks ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing Ron Chernow for his new book on Ulysses S. Grant. I've read every book he's written, and I love the way he talks about that his job as a biographer is to probe the silences, what the subject doesn't want to talk about. For instance, in Grant's case, even though he's got a two-volume set of military memoirs, there are extraordinary things like the accusations about his drinking or his abject poverty at one time during his life that aren't even in the memoirs. And then stay tuned after my interview with Ron Chernow to hear what is currently on my nightstand. But first, my interview with Ron. We are joined today by Ron Chernow, who is one of the most acclaimed biographers alive today, and the only one, of course, to see a significant biography of his turned into a record-breaking hip-hop musical. I won't keep you in suspense. It's called Hamilton. But for those of you who might have first met Ron Chernow through the book Hamilton, please know that he's written The House of Morgan, which won the National Book Award, The Warburgs, which won the George Eccles Prize, Titan, The Life of John D. Rockefeller, nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award, Washington, A Life, which won that little Pulitzer Prize for biography, and then Alexander Hamilton, nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and, as I said, adapted into the award-winning Broadway musical. His new book, which is a biography of Ulysses S. Grant, is sweeping and a dramatic portrait of one of our most compelling generals and presidents. Ulysses S. Grant's life has typically been misunderstood. He's often characterized as a chronic loser or an inept businessman or the triumphant but brutal Union general of the Civil War. But these stereotypes don't come close to capturing him, as Chernow shows in his masterful biography. The first to provide a complete understanding of the general and the president whose fortunes rose and fell with dizzying speed, Chernow brings lucidity, breadth, and meticulousness in telling the story and creating the thread that binds these seemingly disparate stories together, shedding new light on the man whom Walt Whitman described as nothing heroic and yet the greatest hero. Welcome, Ron Chernow.
That was a very beautiful introduction. Thank you for those overly generous comments. Thank you.
Well, Ron, I mentioned to you right before we were on the air, I have read every biography that you've written, and each one I think, oh, my God, I love this one. I love that one, because you have this capacity for us to meet these people in such a full-bodied way for both their outside life and their inside life. The question I'd like to start with is, so your early biographies, Warburg, Rockefeller, and J.P. Morgan, were businessmen, also philanthropists, but primarily defined by being businessmen. What caused the pivot to Washington, Hamilton, and now Grant?
Well, you're right, Roxanne. I had done a series of biographies of moguls of the Gilded Age. And what happened after my Rockefeller biography, Titan, was published, I was out on the road doing publicity. And at the end, people in the audience would start shouting out, "Do Carnegie next, do Vanderbilt next," as if I was going to spend the rest of my life knocking off one Gilded Age tycoon after another. And having written about the Morgans, the Warburgs, and the Rockefellers, I really felt that I was going to say that I had said what I was going to say about American economic and financial history. And I think that it's very, very important for writers periodically to change direction, to stay fresh. And one of the reasons that I chose Alexander Hamilton, I thought that that would be the perfect exit strategy, as it were, that there would be kind of enough about finance in there. After all, he was the first Treasury Secretary. There would be enough about finance in there to please the readers who had read my earlier books. At the same time, it would not only open me up to a new period, but to so many new issues. I would be dealing with constitutional law, foreign policy, military history, nothing less than the creation of the country. And the interesting thing is when I then did George Washington, I don't think that there were a half a dozen people who said to me, "Ron, there's no finance there."
Right.
And Alexander Hamilton in between. So it became this natural segue.
So you switched
over. So now
over.
I seem to be on to presidents and generals from Washington to Grant.
And in telling the story, since there was, you know, Grant, as I'm sure most people know, published what's considered one of the finest memoirs written by a president, a two-volume set that's now in print from Library of America. Not that I'm suggesting as many people read that as will read your biography, because I doubt it. But what's the story about Grant that you wanted to tell?
Well, let me just first say, you know, about Grant's memoirs, which are, you know, justly famous. When I started working on the book, I ran into a friend who said to me, "Ron, how can you write a great biography about someone who wrote a great autobiography?" And I have to say, I wandered around for several days thinking about that question, kind of stopped me dead in my tracks. But then I realized that my job as a biographer is to probe the silences. My job is to talk about what my subject doesn't want to talk about. So Grant and his memoirs, and after all, they're just military memoirs. They don't deal, for instance, with the two-term presidency. But in his memoirs, there's not a single syllable about the drinking problem that permeated his life. In the 1850s, he underwent terrible poverty. He was struggling to support his wife and four children as a farmer in St. Louis. He was reduced to selling firewood on street corners in St. Louis. Well, that 3 or 4 year period, he skips over in a couple of sentences. So actually, that very much kind of helped to guide me in writing the book in terms of talking about exactly those things that Ulysses S. Grant did not want to talk about.
And, you know, Ron, before we come back to the original question, which you wisely enhanced, you know, one of the things I once went to a panel at NYU by biographers that you were on, and you were talking about the process of writing George Washington's biography. And the question that had been asked from the audience is there a risk that the biographer becomes so immersed in the life of the subject of their biography that they become biased in a different way?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's always a risk about that. It's a very human and natural response that the more you research someone's life, that you begin to sympathize with them because you see the world through their eyes. I've done books about people I admire, and I feel, Roxanne, that it's not right to start on a biography if you dislike someone.
Yeah.
If you end up disliking them, you know, in the course
That's
of doing
different.
Research, you know, fine and dandy. But I feel that you kind of owe it, you know, to your subject to have a presumption, you know, in favor of the subject. But I've written about people I admire. I've been lucky, I guess, that in every case without exception, the more I learned about them, the more I admired them. Mm. But what I do, because these are admiring books, I go out of my way to make sure that every flaw is duly noted in the book. And I have often said great figures can carry the weight of their own defects. I assume that my readers are grown-ups, that they're sophisticated people, that they know that history is not the lives of saints. And what I have found, and this was particularly true with Hamilton, both the book and the musical, that the more you talk about the flaws of a great figure, paradoxically, the more people admire them because it humanizes them. And I hear this all the time from, you know, people seeing the show where his flaws are very much on display, but they come out of the theater loving him. And so, but I'm always very, very careful to note the flaws. My biggest fear is that a reviewer or a reader will say, well, of course, Chernow admired so-and-so because he didn't mention, you know, that he had done X. And they all had flaws. They were all very human figures.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was struck by in reading the biography, which despite its heft, is riveting, and you barely realize that you've gone through 900 and something pages. But you talk about, I mean, there's such a dichotomy about Grant's life. So spend a minute first about elaborating on Grant's failures before the Civil War.
Well, his failures were kind of numerous and repeated. He failed at one business after another. He also was hounded out of the army because he was caught drinking on payday. Grant not only failed at one business after another, he seemed to be an incurably naive and trusting person who was also cheated by one business partner after another. And finally, what happens, Roxanne, as you know from reading the book, is that by the time the Civil War breaks out in 1861, Grant has been reduced to going to his father and begging for a job as a clerk in his father's leather goods store in Galena, Illinois. And Grant would be working as a clerk junior to his two younger brothers. Grant was almost 40 years old at this point. But the miraculous thing about this story is that this man who seems to be a certifiable, you know, failure by the time that he's in his late 30s, the Civil War breaks out, and 2 months later he's a colonel. And 4 months later, he's a brigadier general. And 10 months later, he's a major general. And the former clerk from the leather goods store in Galena, Illinois, by April 1865, is the general-in-chief of the Union Army and has a million soldiers under his command. Doesn't get better than that, you know, in terms of storytelling.
What qualities might have been evident while he was experiencing those failures? He did go to West Point. He was pretty much at the bottom of his class at West Point. So were there glimpses of the qualities that then led to his success, or was just the yin and yang of who he was?
That's an excellent question. Yeah, because, you know, number one, he was around the middle of his class at West Point. He graduated 21 out of 39. He'd been in the Mexican War, where he actually distinguished himself.
Right.
He was a very good soldier. He didn't want to be a soldier. It was one of those cases where he excelled at the very thing in life, you know, that he was least interested in. But one could also see, even during these business failures, he was a very decent, determined, and hard-working individual who just simply did not have an aptitude for what he was trying to do. He was, you know, smart, perceptive. There was a dignity about him, a decency, a tremendous sense of responsibility, and also the sense of kind of never turning back, which becomes his trademark.
When we think about his success, one of the things that I hadn't realized is his wife, Julia Dent, who came from a well-to-do slave-owning family in St. Louis, for a period of time seemed significantly more ambitious on her husband's part than he might have been.
Well, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's a fascinating marriage because Grant comes from an abolitionist family in Southwest Ohio. He marries into a slave-owning, you know, family in Missouri. Julia's family had up to 30 slaves, and it was a wonderful marriage, unconditional love, total loyalty to each other. People said that they were almost like teenagers. They would always hold hands together. They were very publicly, you know, affectionate with each other. But Julia was a very determined woman, and in many ways, she had a deeper belief in Ulysses than he had in himself. And unquestionably, she was more ambitious for him than he was for himself. In fact, she so delighted in being the first lady for 8 years that she really prodded her husband to try to grab the Republican nomination for president a third time because she missed the White House. She had the fire in the belly that he didn't have, although he was more ambitious than he cared to admit. Julia was kind of more openly ambitious.
Because even during that third attempt at the presidency, he wasn't even willing to declare.
Wasn't willing to declare, yeah. She kept kind of prodding him to go to Chicago where the convention was. She was very determined, you know, and feisty lady in that way. And she loved being in the limelight. She had been a kind of pampered Southern belle growing up on this slave plantation. And so I think that when she was first lady, she loved being in the center of the social world, whereas her husband was very shambling and awkward in social situations. And she was much more socially adept. She taught him how to dress and, I think, you know, behave on various occasions. It's kind of a grand story. It's an interesting one for someone who turned out to be such a successful politician. He was not a social animal, you know?
Reminded me a little bit of the way Winston Churchill's wife, Clementine, was an active, observing, critical, urging wife.
I think that that's a very good point, a good analogy, that Julia, in a certain way, was much more worldly than her husband was, and certainly much more sociable. She loved parties. She loved all sorts of gatherings. And this was really very important for the wife of a politician who was not comfortable in a lot of social situations. Grant was actually reminded me a lot of George Washington to the extent that Washington, in large social groups, would get very quiet and could be ill at ease. In a small group of people, George Washington would open up and he would be a magnificent storyteller and start regaling people with stories of the Revolutionary War. It was exactly the same way with Grant. Could be very silent and very wary around strangers. Small group of people whom he trusted, he would regale them with stories of the Mexican War and the Civil War, and was actually a very, very entertaining conversationalist. But
I've heard that said about George W. Bush as well.
Yeah, that may be, you know, that may be, it's a certain type. I also say, in the book, that there's a certain kind of bashful man who needs the unconditional love of a strong woman to support him. And I think that, you know, particularly Grant went through so much failure. He wrestled with the drinking problem. I think that Julia Grant was really kind of the emotional anchor of his life. And there were a lot of people in the Grant family, you know, who saw him almost as a henpecked husband, you know, that Julia was the dominant and stronger personality. I think that's probably overstating it. But she, Grant always knew that Julia was fiercely in his corner, you know, in any situation. And that meant a great deal. And it's interesting for someone so successful, no reports of Grant having a roving eye. Readers will be disappointed. There's no sex scandal in this book. He wasn't Alexander Hamilton. He seemed to be someone, he met Julia at a fairly young age, fell in love with her very quickly, and adored her. And in fact, she had strabismus. She was cross-eyed. She had a lazy eye, and she was very self-conscious about it. Caused a lot of physical problems for her. And one day during the late in the war, she went to a doctor to see if she could have corrective eye surgery. And Grant was really perplexed and opposed to this when she told him. And Julia, it's a very poignant line. She said, "Oh, Ulysses, you've become such a great man and you have such a plain little wife." You know, she was afraid she wouldn't do. And Ulysses said to her, "Weren't these the two eyes that I fell in love with? And how do you think I would ever want that changed? I mean, who could ask for more from a spouse, you know?"
Doesn't get better than that. So, Ron, Grant's presidency, he was a two-term president.
Yeah.
Followed Andrew Johnson, who was a disaster after Lincoln's assassination.
Right.
Has been shadowed by charges of corruption and nepotism. Is that an unfair stereotype of his presidency?
Well, what I argue in the book, I spent a lot of time on both the scandals and the nepotism, and I should point out that the scandals did not involve him personally. That is, he was, you know, untouched by it. You know, so the criticism was that he had failed to see these very shady characters, you know, in his entourage. But, you know, what I try to show in the book is that the scandals, which have very much dominated his historical reputation to the point of caricature, I argue that this is kind of the minor story. It was important, but it was the minor story of his administration. The major story is what he did to protect the 4 million African Americans who had been born into slavery in the South, and who, of course, by the end of the Civil War had been emancipated. But to Grant fell a very difficult task. Number one, he had to reintegrate back into the Union the 13 seceded states. Not all of them had rejoined the Union, you know, on a full-fledged basis by the time he became president. But it was Grant who had to enforce the 14th Amendment that gave those 4 million freed slaves full citizenship rights. And then the 15th Amendment, the most explosive, the most controversial, gave blacks the right to vote. And this triggered off a massive and violent backlash in the South. After all, there were states like South Carolina and Mississippi where blacks are the majority, so the white community was terrified of blacks having the right to vote. And that violent backlash was organized by the Ku Klux Klan, which came to exercise a reign of terror in most, if not all, southern counties. You know, and it was Grant who hired a crusading attorney general who brought 3,000 indictments against the Klan and crushed it. And there was no one after Abraham Lincoln who did more for the African-American community than Ulysses S. Grant. And so for me, Roxanne, this is so much more important a story and required so much courage, because not only was Grant dealing with this violent backlash among many white Southerners, but as his presidency went on, you know, many northern liberals began to weary of the need to send federal troops in the South to protect
the South
African Americans. So he was showing courage not only against the opposition party, which one could say is easy, but he was showing courage against his own party, and that requires a considerable degree of courage.
Well, I was struck by two things. One is, to me, reading about his role and bravery in dealing with Reconstruction represented the common quality that existed throughout his life, which was a very kind and understanding sense of humanity. I mean, even during his failures, he always seemed to have that kind of sense of fair play and humanity. And it, to me, blossomed in his role during Reconstruction. And what it really made me think about is, what ramifications do you see today directly from the vicissitudes of Reconstruction under Grant's presidency?
This actually goes back to your, you know, first question, which I failed to answer why I wanted to.
I was going
to
bring you back.
Write the book. It's just, you know, I knew that Grant's life would be the perfect prism through which to view, one, the Civil War, and two, Reconstruction. There are many Americans who have an enormously detailed knowledge of the Civil War and know little or nothing about Reconstruction. But Reconstruction was the second act of the drama. If you don't know what happened in Reconstruction, it's like walking out of the drama in the Civil War in the middle of the play. You know, you don't know how it really ended, because the South managed to roll back many of the gains of the war and kind of reasserting the status quo ante, everything except for slavery. But the blacks were still kept in a condition of sort of quasi-servitude, you know, during that period. So this is really what I want to get at. And what I, you know, often say to people about Reconstruction is it's the black hole of American history for most Americans, but it's the one they need to know most.
And so little has been written about it.
Yeah, I think you can't, for instance, understand why for 150 years we've had a solid South. First, it was a solid Democratic South, then starting 1960s, 1970s, it became a solid Republican South. All of that comes out of Reconstruction, the resentment of the white South, the federal government sending in troops to protect black citizens, you know, and it created an ongoing hostility to this day towards the federal government. It's, you know, still widely taught in Southern schools, not all, but many, that the cause of the Civil War was not slavery, it was states' rights. You know, it was this despotic Northern government invaded the South. And I really thought that to understand contemporary political attitudes, one has to go back to this history. You know, it all boils down to the stories we tell ourselves and our understanding of these historical events. And there are two competing narratives about what happened during the Civil War and Reconstruction. You know, and there's one in the South, and there's one in the rest of the country. That's kind of an overstatement. So I think that it's extremely, extremely important to understand. You know, and the other thing is, and I have to say, I was guilty of this too. Until I did this book, I didn't realize the extent to which there had been a civil rights movement in this country in the late 1860s and early 1870s. We all know the civil rights movement in the 1950s, 1960s. I'll never forget coming upon that letter that General Philip Sheridan sent to Grant in 1867 from New Orleans saying, "We desegregated streetcars in New Orleans today." He said, up until this time, the blacks rode in one streetcar, you know, and the whites rode in another. Now they're happily sitting side by side. 1867, you know. We had the Civil Rights Act of 1866. We had a Civil Rights Act of 1875. All of this is completely unknown to most Americans.
And I think, Ron, you know, the other story that to me is also not told is, so that happened during Reconstruction, which I think would surprise most people, and it, you know, as you just elaborated on. But then there was the backlash that serious and successful attempts were made to put blacks in the South back in the position that they had been in, not quite pre-Civil War, but certainly more approximate to that.
Yeah, they passed these things called, you know, the Black Codes.
Yeah.
That essentially, you know, tied them down to the same plantations that they had been working before the war. It was a new form of servitude. So they had very, very few freedoms. And, you know, one point I just wanted to add, because we were talking before about the stereotype of Grant, President Grant, with the scandals. Well, part of that was that in 1874, as part of the backlash against Reconstruction in the South, the Democratic Party, again, the liberal party at the time was the Republicans, Grant's party. The Democrats in 1874 took over the Congress, and they launched all these hearings into corruption in the Grant administration. And basically, and there was a lot of corruption, but there was a lot of corruption in Johnson's administration, Lincoln's administration. It was very widespread in the, you know, in mid-19th century America. But basically, you know, the Democrats who were conducting those hearings into scandals in the Grant administration were really trying to discredit Grant, not because they were so upset about the corruption, they were upset about Reconstruction. And so they really used that, you know, image of the corrupt Grant in order to discredit him and the whole policy of Reconstruction in the South.
Well, because that, I wonder if that dovetails. One of the questions I was going to ask you was, lots of presidents have had failures of policy or personal challenges that are no better or worse than Grant's, yet his reputation has remained sort of tarnished.
I think it's coming up. You know, the books written about him over the last 10 or 15 years have, without exception, had a much more favorable interpretation.
But I don't think it's penetrated common sensibility.
I think the big change is Grant was the president most associated with Reconstruction. For many years after the Civil War, the history of the Civil War and Reconstruction was dominated by Southern historians, and Reconstruction was presented as a fiasco. There were these corrupt carpetbaggers, there were these illiterate black legislators, and you see that it was incorporated, that view, into the first movie, Birth of the Nation, back in 1915. It was incorporated, many of those views into Gone with the Wind. What's happened over the last generation or two, led by people like Eric Foner at Columbia, is that there's been a complete revision of the view of Reconstruction as a very noble attempt to create a biracial society in the South, complete with a widespread civil rights movement. And so I think that what's happening, it kind of starts with the professional historians and biographers and then eventually filters down,
right,
is that as we see Reconstruction as, if a failure, a very noble failure, that if Reconstruction was good, then Grant was a good president. If Reconstruction was bad, since
he was going to go down
then,
with it.
Yeah, so I think that really his reputation fell when the general view of Reconstruction was that it was a fiasco. And as there has been this, revisionist view that it was, if a failure, a very noble failure, I think that Grant's standing has been reassessed and has risen.
But certainly for its bravery. Well, we can't talk about Grant without talking about him and Robert E. Lee.
Right.
So what I'd love to do is two parts. One is get your view on what Grant thought about him, and then maybe read a little piece from the book of the ultimate showdown between Robert E. Lee.
Grant had a lot of respect for Robert E. Lee as a general, but he did think that he was overrated. He said Lee was a man who needed sunshine. He felt that Lee, both during and after the war, there was this uncritical adoration in the press. I think that he felt that Lee was a brilliant tactician in individual battles, but did not have a really kind of sophisticated overall strategic sense of how to win the war, which Grant certainly did. He also felt after the war that Lee was kind of quietly working against Reconstruction.
Yeah.
Lee opposed the 15th Amendment, giving blacks the right to vote, etc. So,
and Grant worked hard to keep Lee from being charged with treason by Johnson.
He saved Lee because after the Civil War, there was a grand jury in Virginia that wanted to indict him for treason. And at that point, President Andrew Johnson wanted Lee prosecuted for treason. Grant, went to the White House.
Even though Grant had given his word to Lee.
Well, Grant, at Appomattox, and this was very kind of key to the agreement, Grant had given his word that the Confederate generals would not be prosecuted for treason, which they easily could have been. And so when suddenly it looked like Lee was going to be prosecuted for treason with the president's blessing, Grant went to the White House and in no uncertain terms told President Johnson that if Robert E. Lee was prosecuted for treason, that he, Grant, would resign because he, Grant, had given Robert E. Lee his sacred word at Appomattox that he would not be prosecuted for treason. It wasn't that Grant thought that, you know, he couldn't be prosecuted for treason, but he felt that they could not have ended the war at that point without that promise, and he was not going to renege on the promise that he made to Lee. And needless to say, Lee was, you know, very, very, you know, touched that suddenly his great opponent, Ulysses S. Grant, you know, is saving him from a treason prosecution.
Right.
It's a great story. Okay, let me read. I'm going to read a portion. Now, this is Grant is approaching Appomattox Courthouse for the famous meeting with Robert E. Lee in April 1865. With the Confederate Army bivouacked in a nearby valley, General Phil Sheridan directed Grant to a brick house on the outskirts of Appomattox Courthouse, where Lee awaited him. The house was owned by Wilmer McLean, who had owned a house at Bull Run, damaged during the first battle there. He had fled to the sleepy hamlet of Appomattox Courthouse, hoping to escape further hostilities. It would now claim the odd distinction of witnessing the beginning of the Civil War in his backyard and its ending in his parlor. Approaching the historic rendezvous, Grant was painfully aware of how poorly costumed he was to enact this lofty scene. His slovenly appearance had come about merely from being detached from his headquarters wagon. He had no inkling that later historians might be charmed by his outfit or assume that his mud-caked clothing made a political statement. Quite simply, Grant hadn't expected to meet Lee this soon. Quote, I had an old suit on without my sword and without any distinguishing mark of rank except the shoulder straps of a lieutenant general on a woolen blouse. I was afraid Lee might think I meant to show him studied discourtesy by so coming, at least I thought so. Later I asked what was uppermost in his mind at this sublime moment. The sheepish Grant said prosaically, my dirty boots and wearing no sword. It's a wonderful line.
Wow. This episode of Just the Right Book is brought to you by BetterHelp. Get on your way to being your best self. Give online therapy a try at betterhelp.com/writebook. We are living in stressful times, and the hustle and bustle of the holidays can make it even more stressful. If you're considering starting therapy, try BetterHelp. It's entirely online and designed to be flexible and convenient. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with the best for you licensed therapist. Now is the time to give yourself what you need with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/writebook today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/writebook. This is Roxanne Cody. Thanks for listening. And now back to Just the Right Book.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So, Ron, we're running out of time, and we haven't gotten to talk about the extraordinary over 2 year round the world trip that Julia and Ulysses S. Grant took after his presidency, or his attempt at getting the nomination again, or how they escaped being assassinated on the same night as Abraham Lincoln. But there's two questions I don't want to miss asking you before I lose you. One is, what was it about Hamilton that made him uniquely suited to a musical, or will we be singing one about Washington, Grant, Rockefeller, and J.P. Morgan?
Well, I haven't. This is my last hip-hop musical anyway. you know, Hamilton's story was improbable. He was illegitimate, orphaned, penniless. He was a self-invented outsider, comes out of nowhere. And becomes a founding father of the country. I think that there were, you know, other things. He, He was handsome. He was dashing. He was romantic, energetic. All wonderful things for your leading man in a Broadway show. People love stories about flawed genius, and Hamilton is the perfect, you know, title of the flawed genius. And then, you know, when I first met Lin-Manuel Miranda and told me he wanted to do this hip-hop musical about Hamilton, I didn't realize, you know, what the connection between Hamilton and hip-hop would be. But as time went on, I saw that the way that Lin was presenting Hamilton in the show was this very driven character. And there was something about that intense, driven character that matched up perfectly with the intense, driven hip-hop rhythms and lyrics.
And an underdog.
And an underdog, yeah. Kind of, you know, underdog who comes out the top dog, at least for a while. And so there's a fairy tale quality about this illegitimate orphan penniless kid. It's like a Dickens story. The way, the dreamlike progression of his life. And then it's also like a Greek tragedy. He goes from strength to strength to strength, and then there's a dying fall, and he's undone by the same qualities that had, you know, driven him to fame.
Yeah, which is not really surprising. I mean, often our greatest strength somehow becomes an element of failure. I mean, I think you see that in lots of stories about great men.
Yeah, but, you know, I said to Lin one day, I said, if one had invented the story, it couldn't have been better invented for dramatization, because a dying fall happens right about two-thirds, three-quarters of the way, you know, through the story. So if you were William Shakespeare doing, you know, a dramatization of this life, that's exactly where you would put it. And this wasn't a structure that I imposed as the author. It was just a structure that happened to be built into Hamilton's life. It was just such a perfectly structured story. And Lin always felt the best way to tell the story is just stick as closely as possible to the truth.
Yeah, so speaking of fairy tale, do you think you would have made up as you're a toiling, albeit critically, wildly critically successful biographer, that you'd become this, like, Broadway impressive?
No, it's been as implausible as any of the stories I've written about. You know, kind of my image pre-Hamilton musical was of this very conscientious, nose-to-the-grindstone biographer.
Now you're a glamour guy.
Yeah, now I'm kind of seen as the hip, cool historian because I hang
out with
this hip, cool young crowd on Broadway, and I love it. It's just been so delightful.
And why not? Why not? And Ron, what are you working on now?
Now I'm just, you know, I'm going to be going out and publicizing the book, and I'm going to wait till I finish the publicity tour, and then I'll figure out what's next. My mind is a little too crowded with Grant at the moment.
Yeah. So one thing that occurred to me as we were having that conversation about Julia, maybe it's time for you to write about a woman.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people have said that, and I'm entirely open to it. There are different women I would love to have written about. Abigail Adams, Eleanor Roosevelt. You know, I always have my eye out for a woman.
So. Yeah, well, and I do think, you know, just the way you've brought, you know, there were other biographies of Washington. There were other biographies of Rockefeller. I think, you know, the one that has always fascinated me is Abigail Adams.
Yeah.
And I love a biography that was done by Lynn Wheatley about her. But I think the kind of eye that you bring to biographies might add a dimension that hasn't been told. And I think the role, like we talked about Julia Grant, and it's known about Abigail Adams, or certainly, you know, even someone like Nancy Reagan, and the obvious being Eleanor Roosevelt, but their roles in these presidencies, I don't think those stories have been told with the kind of skill that you could bring to it.
Well, thank you. I will think about that. That's nice of you to say. But, you know, I have with all the people that I've written about, there have been many previous biographies. In fact, when I did George Washington, there had been 900 previous biographies since his death. So it was kind of an act of hubris to perpetrate number 901. And, you know, I did it. And the same was true with Grant, because there have been good books about Grant written in recent years. But I just felt that I did a certain kind of narrative biography that was different from the way that other people handled it. So my career has really been based on that premise that I'm going to, you know, do a different sort of biography.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I would say, you know, the one that really got my attention first of your books was Titan, mm-hmm. which presented an entirely different understanding of John D. Rockefeller, where he too had a reputation that was slightly one-dimensional.
Yeah, I have a kind of contrarian streak, and I kind of like to take these, you know, stereotypes and then work off them. And people always turn out to be much more complicated than the stereotype. There's always some kind of, you know, historical cartoon that you start out dealing with. And then as you get deeper into the research, you're dealing with real human beings with strengths and flaws. Rockefeller certainly had his flaws, and I tried not to stint, you know, in telling that story. But there are also kind of wonderful sides to his life, notably the philanthropy, and I really wanted to do justice to that and really kind of create a rounded and truthful picture of the person.
So, Ron, the question I often, or if not always, ask authors is, what's the book that changed your life?
That's a very good question. Well, I don't know if this is the book that changed my life, but I think that it's germane with Grant. When I was a teenager, I read Carl Sandburg's Lincoln, and I could remember I was just absolutely enchanted and transported. I could still remember his description of, you know, the night of Lincoln going off to Ford's Theater. I was quite haunted by all of those stories and lines. And so when I started doing Grant, I thought, oh, nice, now I'll get to read Carl Sandburg again all these years later. I read 8 or 10 pages. I couldn't go on because the first 8 or 10 pages about Abraham Lincoln's mother, about whom we know next to nothing. And it was just one completely invented scene after another. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, my God. how the great have fallen.
Do you know which biography of Abraham Lincoln, and I'm regretting I'm not remembering his name, but I picked up a biography of his that was written by a British guy who was contemporaneous. It was written in the early 1900s.
Uh-huh.
And so he had been alive during the Civil War. And that is a fascinating way to read.
Like, I would like to know the name.
I'll send you the name.
I would, yeah. Actually, the biography, because there's a lot of good books on Lincoln. But the one that I used the most in doing the Grant biography was the David Herbert Donald, you know, which is simply called Lincoln. I just find it's clear, it's lucid, you know, it's reliable, and that's what I needed.
That came out in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. But this British one, I mean, it's a little slice of Lincoln. It's not quite the, you know, the big biography like the one that you're referring to. But it was just such a fascinating perspective, first from a Brit, and two, from someone of that time.
Well, I would love to read that. Yeah,
I'll send the name.
Clearly one that I'm not familiar with, but maybe that'll be my airplane reading.
All right.
Sure.
Ron, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Roxanne. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks again to Ron Chernow. His book, Grant, is now available. And I'll leave you with what's currently on my nightstand, which is Jennifer Egan's Manhattan Beach. Jennifer Egan is well-known. Manhattan Beach is a little bit different. I've just started it, but it's about a young woman who ends up working at the Naval Yard in Brooklyn. You know, before Brooklyn was all about the Naval Yard being about concerts, it was about building ships. And Jennifer brings her normal, incredible talent for storytelling to Manhattan Beach. And the second book, which I just started, is Jesmyn Ward, Sing, Unburied, Sing. She has been renowned since her first book was published, Salvage the Bones. She has the capacity to tell a story. This one's based in Mississippi and talks about the complexity of the heritage of the state of Mississippi in a way that feels multidimensional and profound. So right now, that's what's on my nightstand, and I'll report back as I finish these to see if they've held up to their fantastic openings. If you haven't subscribed yet, please subscribe to Just the Right Book podcast on iTunes and help us spread the word by telling your friends, your family, anyone who loves books And for a complete list of all the books we've talked about, just go to bookpodcast.com. Just the Right Book Podcast is produced by Collisions, the podcast division of CRN International. Our original music was created by Mark Berman. Many thanks to our sound engineer, Pat Keough, and our producer, Christina Torres. Thank you all so much for listening.